Let's talk about compassionate connections. Here's the protocol. You'll want to ask, are there any compassionate connections with any other soul? If yes, how many compassionate connections are present? And who have these compassionate connections been created with? Is it family members, friends, coworkers, clients, and so on? So compassionate connections form when we unconsciously allow another soul to draw on our vital force energy because we feel compassion towards them. Of course, this is at all times inappropriate and unnecessary. Relationships are designed to be an even and equal exchange of energy. Now, we often create compassionate connections when we help others, whether they want it or not, because sometimes they really don't, and we never receive anything back. So compassionate connections can be created when the relationship's a one-way street. We're constantly giving, 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 giving. Nothing ever comes back to us. That is our responsibility. It's not the other person taking our energy. We're giving it to them freely, over and over again, and again, and again. All right, so we are responsible for creating these. Compassionate connections can also be a sign that we have a bit of a superiority complex, to be honest. After all, the idea that we have help to offer, but the other person has nothing to offer us in return, is not upholding them as a divine being, but there are people that feel really good when they're like, oh, I'm a giver. Let me just give and give. Oh no, don't give me anything back. No, that's okay. I'm just here to give. But what they're really saying is, you have nothing of value to offer in return. That's what we're basically saying when we're putting us into the position of helper that just dispenses altruistically. We're saying that the other person involved has no value to offer us in return. And that's not upholding them as a divine being. But there are people out there that makes them feel terribly good. It's like, oh, I'm so giving. They have nothing to give back to me because I'm all that. But I'm so generous, right? It's a little bit of a superiority complex. It really can be. Now, sometimes it's also just an investment in trying to help people where we're actually not accepting of who they are. We want to help so badly. Like, usually this is about us, right? When we're trying to fix the world and the world doesn't necessarily think it's broken. And we do that with people where we try to fix someone's life and they're actually pretty happy with their life. Or even if they're not happy with their life, they're not as invested in fixing themselves as we are. But that's about us. And our unwillingness to accept that person where they are, sometimes someone not helping themselves can be inconvenient for us. So compassionate connections can also be a sign of being a bit of a control freak, quite frankly. But in any case, it's always that we're helping, we're assisting, we're doing for others, and there's an imbalance in the relationship. We're really not receiving back from that person. So if we're perpetually giving someone our time, attention, advice, or even financial support in an effort to help, but receive nothing back, that is how compassionate connections are created. Now, it takes time to do that. It's not like you help someone once and then nothing comes back to you, poof, you have a compassionate connection. No, this is over a long period of time. But you know, I mean, there's people who give and give and give to the same person for months, if not years, and nothing ever comes back to them. So that's really where compassionate connections start. Now, especially for those of us who are natural helpers and healers, and we really, really want to save the world, it is important to uphold excellent boundaries. It's fantastic to offer assistance. I am a fan of offering people assistance, but it's also a good idea to see if the other person actually does something with that assistance. And like I said, it's not upholding another's divinity to only give without receiving back from them. So I'm a fan of helping once or twice, but then also paying attention to, is the person taking that assistance and are they helping themselves? Because there's lots of people out there who are, I mean, first of all, they have low self-esteem and a strong sense of entitlement. And so they're highly comfortable just sitting there and receiving and receiving and receiving and expecting their lives to change without ever helping themselves. There are certainly those types of people out there. Most people, though, are actually not that comfortable only receiving. Most of us, when someone offers us assistance and we receive it, we want to give back because inherently we all realize that relationships are designed for an even and equal exchange of energy. And if we have any self-esteem at all, we know that we have value to offer back to that person that just helped us. So most people really don't feel all that comfortable just being on the receiving end all the time. But some really do. They're like these bottomless pits of need, and you can give and give and give all day long, and they're like, thanks. But their lives never change. So over time, compassionate connections can become quite draining. And while compassionate connections begin through choices to give assistance, made at the physical level, right? At the level of action, they can also persist energetically long after the relationship has ended on the physical plane. And this will be characterized by our clients still thinking about that person, worrying about them, wondering whether they ever resolve their problem, and so on. So remember, blocks and restrictions always are created through choice. So initially, we'll help at the level of action, we'll do something for the other person, or we'll give them advice, we'll invest our time. There's gonna be some effort involved on our part. Now, we may over time realize that this person is just an energy suck, right? And they don't really wanna change their lives. And so we let that relationship go in the physical. We don't talk to them anymore. We don't spend time with them, but they'll still pop into our heads. And we'll still think about them. And we'll wonder, how are they doing? I wonder if they ever did, you know, the thing that we talked about. So we're still giving them our vital force energy, but now we're doing it at the mental level. And that is typical of compassionate connections. Now, we generally want to know how many compassionate connections are present and to whom they're being offered. There's no need to be terribly specific. We could say family member, friend, client. You can designate as female, male, family member, that sort of thing. Now, one quick note on this. Sometimes the family member designation can be symbolic. So, for example, if female family member feels like a sister, comes up and your client's like, well, I don't have a sister. Often it's someone that they consider to be like a sister, a really close female friend that feels like family. Sometimes a father can come up and they're like, well, my dad has passed. And it's like, well, is there a father figure that you were trying to help at some point that you no longer have a relationship with, maybe, but they were like a father for a while. And then they might say, oh, you know, I was really close with my ex-boyfriend's dad. And he taught me a bunch of stuff, and I really tried to help him with his business, and that didn't work out. And they'll be like, oh, that's it. So sometimes these designations are more symbolic than literal. Remember, we're just looking at energy at the fifth dimensional level. Now, when we clear these connections, we must also instruct our client to maintain appropriate boundaries, energetic and otherwise, and to tune into the difference between enabling others versus actually empowering them to help themselves. And you'll also want to tell your clients to not send their mental energy towards that person anymore. The clearing work really helps with that. But, you know, if that person pops into your client's head, they'll want to immediately redirect their thoughts and not give their mental focus to that person anymore. And that way the situation will just dissipate. So compassionate connections are always a present life phenomenon. That energy exchange where we're giving our vital force energy is happening at the physical level through effort and at the mental level through attention. So we discard our physical and our mental body when we transition. We don't take those with us, right? And so compassionate connections are only present life. They also do not serve as an attachment mechanism for attaching souls. So compassionate connections are not an attachment mechanism at all. So let's talk about contracts. You'll want to ask, are there any contracts in my client's record? Then you want to ask, is it a contract of protection, a contract of healing, or a soulmate contract? And people can certainly have multiple kinds of contracts open, but generally they don't have more than one, maybe two. It would be very odd to find a whole bunch of contracts for a client. You'll want to ask, was this contract created in a past life? And 99.9% of the time, the answer is yes. Then you'll want to ask, was it created as a one-sided contract or a mutual contract? It's going to be one or the other. And you'll also want to ask, is it currently one-sided or mutual? And finally, for contracts of protection and healing, you'll want to ask, is my client on the receiving or giving end of the contract? Now let's talk about this. In the context of our soul realignment modality, contracts are negative agreements we make with others, and they can serve as an attachment mechanism for attaching souls and are mainly a past life issue. Now, I stress that this is how we define it in the context of the soul realignment modality. I am well aware that in the spiritual development world, there's talk about soul level contracts and all of that stuff. I don't know how other people define it, but we have very specific definitions within this modality. So if you've come across the concept of contracts before, please understand that we're using that term in a very specific way, and just make that a part of your frame of reference when you're doing soul realignment work specifically. Now, contracts can be mutual or one-sided. They can also start out as a mutual contract between two people, but then over time, one soul might release the contract while the other doesn't. And that's how a mutual contract can turn into a one-sided contract. Now, contracts that start as one-sided cannot become mutual. So if a contract starts as one-sided, it stays one-sided. Now, contracts are not created consciously. It's not like we sit down and sign a piece of paper with someone. They are created in highly intense and often traumatic situations where one person decides to take responsibility for another. In the case of a mutual contract, the other person is actually willing to abdicate that responsibility to them. Now, in our frame of reference, like I said, contracts are always negative agreements. It's never appropriate for us to take responsibility that isn't ours or to abdicate our responsibilities to another person. And keep in mind, contracts are not just there at soul level. They are formed through actual choices made, which happen at the level of action. I know I keep stressing it, but it's important. Just because in the spiritual development world, there is this idea of souls making contracts with one another, that's not what we're talking about, okay? When we're talking about contracts in soul realignment, they're negative agreements. And when I say one person decided to take responsibility for another, they literally did something that that person was able to do for themselves and should have done for themselves because it was their responsibility. Now, in a mutual contract, that other person let them. Go ahead, do this for me. I don't want a deal. You do it for me. So this is happening at the level of choice and action. So it's not just a soul level agreement. This is actually a situation that took place between two incarnated people. One person did the responsibility of another. Now, in a contract of protection, one person steps in to protect another person. Now, this often happens between family members, and usually the contracts start as mutual, but they can occasionally start out as one-sided. So, for example, a sibling might take it upon themselves to protect their younger sibling against abusive parents by allowing themselves to bear the brunt of their abuse. A mother might enter a life of prostitution in order to protect her children. So these are situations that do involve trauma, physical abuse, some danger. And certainly contracts like this can be mutual, where siblings try to protect each other from abusive parents. That happens too. So it just depends, and you'll learn how to research more of the story around a contract when we get to lesson 8. So usually the situations from which protection is required are ongoing, resulting in very deeply entrenched patterns of behavior and choice by both people involved. So remember these situations, these agreements that we make with one another, these relationships dynamics that we create. The reason that we're still seeing these blocks and restrictions is that they never got resolved in the lifetime in which they originated. So this agreement, this negative agreement between those two people, they upheld that agreement all the way until they both transitioned, or in the case of a one-sided contract, until that person transitioned. So you might have two siblings who try to protect each other from abusive parents, and that's great, but eventually they grow up. But guess what? They never let that pattern go. They still are constantly trying to take responsibility for each other and from each other in a sort of mutually protective way that is dysfunctional, though. Because, you know, it's one thing to cope with an abusive childhood. It's quite another when you're persistent in that pattern when you're 40 or 50 years old. It interferes with relationships, all kinds of stuff, right? So this is why these agreements are negative. Because even though we understand the impetus, I mean, certainly a mother will do anything to protect her children. Anything. But what about when those children are adults and able to protect themselves? It's no longer appropriate to keep protecting them. They're adults. So that's why these agreements are so negative. It's not just the situation in which they started. Certainly that's usually one of trauma. It's that they never, ever, ever evolved past that situation. Now, obviously, not all acts of protecting someone will evolve into a contract. Because most of the time, once the danger is gone, we let that agreement go because it's no longer necessary. So contracts are really formed when one person takes responsibility for another, or they take responsibility for each other, right? And then one person abdicates responsibility all the time. So there's this weird enmeshment going on, and that pattern never gets resolved, even though the situation that started it all is over. And that's really why these agreements are so negative. There's always situations where we just have to cope. But once that situation is over, we need to change our patterns of choice, and we can change our patterns of choice. Well, in the situation of a contract, the mechanism that served to protect one person became really, really dysfunctional later on in life and really stopped serving that person, and now it's negative. It's not allowing them to live their divine self-expression. Now, in a contract of healing, one person decides they're responsible for healing another. And again, these contracts start as mutual or one-sided. So for example, a lover may decide they're responsible for the emotional healing of their partner, who may or may not need or want healing, by the way. And they might start tolerating irresponsible behavior in their partner in an effort to make them feel good. A mother might take responsibility for healing her child if that child is physically disabled or sickly by constantly engaging in acts of sacrifice. And in a mutual contract of healing, for example, between a mother and child, a child may actually learn to interpret the attention she receives when she is sick as love. And so manifest continuing physical issues, because that's how this child has learned to receive love, by having problems. Some people actually do that. Some people turn into hypochondriacs because they've learned that how they receive love and attention from others is by not being well. So the mother then might become quite invested in her role as martyr. And again, this dynamic won't resolve through their entire lifetime, and then they transition, still upholding this agreement, and so it becomes part of their divine soul blueprint. Contracts are usually are not usually created because of a one-time event. It's really through ongoing patterns of choice made by one or in a mutual contract, both people involved, for the duration of their shared incarnation. Obviously, again, just like with protection contracts, not all illnesses trigger contracts. Disease is a part of life. Most of us realize we can't do someone else's healing for them. And if we try, in the case of a parent, eventually that child grows up, and the whole point of a child growing up is that they become responsible for themselves, and hopefully as parents we recognize that. Now, if a protection or healing contract is one-sided for the client, and the client is on the giving end of the contract, you'll find that the client may forever be getting into other people's business. They're always looking to protect someone or heal someone, which can be really annoying. Quite frankly, if someone's trying to fix you and you don't think you're broken, or someone's trying to protect you and you're like, I'm perfectly safe. But so they can be very intrusive and really have very poor boundaries because they're constantly trying to take responsibility that isn't there. Most of us don't like that. We really don't. It's a disempowerment. Some people will totally engage with that, of course. They love abdicating responsibility, and they'll usually attract people that abdicate responsibility. Now, if a protection and healing contract is one-sided with the client on the receiving end, it looks a little different. Now the client may constantly expect others to take responsibility for them. So they may have the sense of entitlement, like, well, other people should be doing this for me. Other people should be taking care of me. I shouldn't have to worry about this for myself. And so it's exactly the opposite. So they'll feel rather entitled to be protected by others or expect others to take responsibility for their physical or even their emotional well-being. Let's talk about soulmate contracts. These are a little different. They are not romantic. In fact, they can be quite toxic. Soulmate contracts are formed when two people make choices to be together forever, no matter what. So they embrace codependency and the idea that they need each other in a way that can be quite destructive and dysfunctional. So think about it this way. Healthy, happy, and aligned relationships have zero need for a contract to keep two people together. It's just not necessary. But some people romanticize difficult relationships and take the love conquers all concept way too literally. So in the lifetime of origination of that soulmate contract, these people will have had to overcome lots of obstacles in order to be together. And really the relationship is formed out of the idea of, you know, we have to overcome all of this and then we'll be together forever, no matter what. But they're also taking action based on that. This is not a conceptual thing again. So they're making choices to overcome obstacles to their being together. But they're really embracing struggle. They really are. And again, you know, the thing is, in a soulmate contract, people are constantly doing struggle. That relationship is characterized by struggle. Because if the energy of a relationship is we're going to be together no matter what life throws at us, well, you know, that's a guarantee for life throwing a lot of stuff at us. So these are not romantic, we're meant to be together kind of relationships. These are, you know, kind of like we're going to be hard-headed about it and we're going to make love about overcoming obstacles, and therefore we'll always manifest new obstacles that need to be overcome. So these are really difficult, difficult relationships. Two souls engaged in a mutual soulmate contract will incarnate together frequently and also engage in partnerships with one another, even though these partnerships can be toxic and lead to negative choices just because there's always that struggle factor. Now, but the two people will feel oddly compelled to be with one another and feel almost like they have no choice but to be in a relationship with them, and it gets very romanticized. They may even characterize their own relationship as good. Now, often it's not, but it provides this level of security and safety for them. They are attached to struggle. And often people in a soulmate relationship think that relationships are about overcoming the relationship itself as the obstacle. So, oh my God, even though this spouse cheated on me, I know we can work it out. Oh, there's a gambling addiction that my spouse has. I'm going to stick by it. And there's always going to be stuff going on like that. So it is a relationship characterized by a lot of struggle. And we already talked about how the ego can be really struggle addicted. And some people really pride themselves and take pride in all the struggles they've overcome together. And look, we've stayed together regardless. And it's like, okay, but it hasn't allowed you to do anything else, right? So the relationship totally supersedes the individual's divine self-expression. And that's why it's so negative, because they're so busy overcoming struggle, they can't go create the life they want. It's just jumping over one hurdle after another. Now, clearing a soulmate contract in no way leads to the end of a relationship. Please understand that. In fact, it can create more love and peace in a relationship because the energy of obligation is no longer present. And also, often, the struggle kind of goes out. Now, sometimes people break up because the struggles are gone. And suddenly, the relationship got boring. Struggle can fuel a lot of passion. It can. It's toxic passion, but passion nevertheless. So now you take that energy of obligation and struggle out of the relationship, and you've got struggle-addicted people. Well, now they're going to create difficulty in other ways, all right? But sometimes it goes the other way, where suddenly there's room for peace and actually building something together that aligns to both people's divine self-expression. And that's really why we clear these contracts, because we want both people to be able to focus on doing their divinity and moving towards a common vision, each while doing their divine self-expression. Now, people with one-sided soulmate contracts may have a very hard time with relationships. They're forever looking for the one, or they struggle with commitment issues, and they'll also be attracted to people that are difficult to be with. People that have problems, people that are living half a world away, right? I mean, it's not very convenient to decide to fall in love with someone who lives on another continent. I mean, that's just a setup for a relationship of struggle, but people with one-sided soulmate contracts will sometimes do that. They'll constantly be searching for the other soul involved in the contract, even though that soul will have cleared their side of the contract already because it's one-sided, right? So they can end up feeling quite bitter and disillusioned about love and relationships. So if a contract is mutual at its inception, it can serve as an attachment mechanism for an attaching soul, but it has to be mutual. Obviously, a one-sided contract can't possibly lead to an attaching soul. So the other soul involved in the mutual contract is then simply not currently incarnated, and so it shows up as an attaching soul to your client. Obviously, when a contract is one-sided, we don't run into that situation since only one soul is involved. Now, because we are more empowered as individuals than ever before in human history, and we expect others to take responsibility for themselves, contracts are usually past life blocks and restrictions. We really don't create contracts anymore. Also, in today's world, there are many institutions and systems in place to help both protect and heal. From the school system to child protective services to the medical establishment, we are not so locked into these situations anymore that we used to have to overcome, where taking responsibility for another was necessary. And quite frankly, relationships have changed a lot. Most of us don't feel compelled to stay married to someone where the whole relationship is an obstacle course. Divorce is far more accepted these days than it was many lifetimes ago. So soulmate contracts of the kind that we're talking about in this program are also really not being created anymore. So contracts are 99.9% of the time a past life issue. So yeah, we don't feel compelled to stay in toxic relationships out of a need for security and safety. So soulmate contracts tend to be a thing of past lives as well.